This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'm very happy to be here this morning. It seems like an auspicious day for you. I heard there's a Shuso ceremony right after the talk. And you're in the midst of your fall practice period. I think at City Center, where I live in practice, we are recovering from Tsukiji, which was last night, and Halloween, with lots of children from down the street at Clara House and their mothers coming trick-or-treating. So I wanted to talk today, or I'd like to talk today about Vimalakirti, since I understand you're studying the Vimalakirti Sutra. And in particular, I've been thinking about Vimalakirti in a different way since this spring when I was studying Taigen Layton's book, Faces of Compassion, which used to be called Bodhisattva Archetypes. And he thinks of Vimalakirti along with the traditional bodhisattvas that we practice with, Manjushri, Samantabhadra, Kuan Yin, and Jizo Bodhisattva. He talks about Vimalakirti as a bodhisattva. And his phrase, bodhisattva archetypes, has to do with recognizing qualities in contemporary people and in each of us that relate to the qualities we see in these traditional bodhisattvas. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about some of the ways in which Vimalakirti manifests as a bodhisattva. Manifested as a bodhisattva, but you know, if we think that everything and everyone in the past is in with us in the present, so I could use the present tense as well to talk about Vimalakirti. And I also want to weave in the teaching about the seventh precept, which we often recite as not praising self at the expense of others. And another way of viewing that precept is meeting others on equal ground, which is something that Vimalakirti did. So when I thought about Vimalakirti and the way he lived his life, that precept came to mind. And I'll weave in also a story of a poet who I think is, in many ways, embodies the spirit of Vimalakirti. And then relate that to how we can practice with the qualities of Vimalakirti in our and with this precept in our everyday lives. So hopefully it will all come together, and I hope it will be helpful. I want to thank Reverend Mio for inviting me to speak today, and I also want to thank my teacher, Agent Linda Cutts, for her support over many years. So starting with Vimalakirti, one of the things that Taigen Layton said that I appreciate is that Vimalakirti's teaching is about seeing through the trappings of religion to the spiritual heart of the wonder of reality. So one of his teachings was about non-duality and seeing beyond opposites or things that we think may be opposites. And certainly when we look at the precept, not praising self at the expense of others, it's based on our seeing things in that way, that others are better or worse than ourselves, and comparing ourselves to others comes out of that thinking that we're separate selves, that dualistic thinking. So this contribution of Vimalakirtis to an understanding of non-duality is one of the one of the teachings that's so beneficial in the Vimalakirti Sutra. And he, in his life, as the story goes, reached out to people from all walks of life. Although he was a family man and a man of some wealth, he practiced as a layman amid the delusions of the world without getting ensnared by them. Although he had great material wealth, and he used his riches to sustain people who were poor, he entered many different realms inhabited by various social classes, from gambling dens and taverns to upper class financial exchanges, engaging in trade, although he was uninterested in his own personal profit. He discussed and understood worldly philosophies and sciences, but he was always in accord with the Buddha's teachings. And he entered brothels to talk about the folly of sexual misconduct and educate the young women who were there and hopefully emancipate them from what they were doing. And he also entered bars to lead alcoholics to right mindfulness. So, Vimalakirti, and this is something that Tigan Layton says, in all his activities embodies the Mahayana view of being in the world but not of it, as Vimalakirti fulfills liberative work without being trapped or fettered by worldly desires or attachments. So he made this his life was centered on being of benefit to others and embodying the Bodhisattva vow in that way, whether it was through his teachings or through his deeds of reaching out and bringing the teachings everywhere he went. Vimalakirti, again, is according to Tigan Layton, emphasizes that the fundamental aspiration emerges out of immersion in the ordinary world of desire, like lotus blossoms growing out of the mire of a swamp. So he didn't separate himself from the world in any way. And as an embodiment of lay practice, really inspires, I think, so many people to fully live in the world, be a householder, have a job, and embody practice, bring practice into daily life. Partly through the way we interact with other people and with ourselves. So, when we think about practicing with the precepts, thinking of the precepts not as rules or, I think sometimes it's difficult when we only word the precepts in the negative. So a disciple of Buddha does not praise self at the expense of others. So what does a disciple of Buddha do? And I find that there are so many versions of the precepts that include the affirmative as well as the prohibitory or the negative. So one of the texts that I really appreciate in working with the precepts is one by Diane Rossetto. She's a Zen teacher who lives in the East Bay. I haven't met her, but I would really like to. And she wrote a book called Waking Up to What You Do. And a lot of the book focuses on her experience with these precepts in working with her students, and has lots of examples, quotes from her students about how they work with the precepts. And one way of working with the precepts is recognizing that we can't necessarily only look at the precepts in the conventional realm or take them literally, but there's also a way in which practicing with the precepts brings us in touch with the larger reality that we're all interconnected, and that what we do affects others as much as what others do affects us, because of that the interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say. So whatever we do, and that our deeds often are follow from our thoughts, have a ripple effect, and we don't practice or live our lives separate from others. So this seventh precept about not praising self at the expense of others is about not comparing ourselves to others, whether we praise ourselves at the expense of others or we praise others at the expense of ourselves. And I think this is such a common thought pattern or tendency that we all have. And it can begin very early in life. Certainly in school, we're being compared to others constantly. And sometimes in our families, we get messages that contribute to that kind of thinking. And I know, I'll give an example from my own family, and I think my mother was very well-meaning when she said this, but I'm the oldest of three sisters, but for a long time there were just two of us. My sister Helen was born when I was a year and a half old, and our third sister wasn't born till I was 13. So she used to say that Helen was the pretty one and I was the smart one. Yeah, that was it didn't have a very helpful effect, I would say, on either one of us. Because I was a year ahead of Helen in school, and I did very well. My mother always told me to, you know, it was important to get a good education. My parents struggled because they grew up in the Depression, and my mother was valedictorian of her high school class, but she couldn't go to college because she had to go to work. So, and my grandparents were all immigrants who spoke Yiddish as their first language and didn't have much education. So my family really valued education. And because I was the oldest, I had to set a good example for my sisters. That was another message that was not so helpful. So I did very well in school. It was I enjoyed studying, and it was also a way to get some positive attention from my parents. Then in high school, I really enjoyed math and science, and so my mother asked me to help my sister Helen with her math and science, which she wasn't doing as well as I was. And neither one of us enjoyed that very much. And then when I left to go to college, Helen's grades went up. So I think it was actually an impediment. And I always thought of Helen as the pretty one, and she dated earlier than I did, even though she was younger. And I didn't think of myself as attractive for many years. And I wanted straight hair like Helen's. You know, you can see my hair is not straight, never was. But I, for a while, tried to straighten my hair. So anyway, that kind of comparison, it can cause so much pain. And how do we free ourselves from it? You know, I think, especially over the years of practicing, that I've worked a lot with sympathetic joy as an antidote to comparing mind, and realizing that if someone else achieves something wonderful, even if it's something that I want and for some reason can't achieve, it's beneficial to me as well. I really had an example of this when I was studying Aikido. I started studying Aikido at the age of 40 because I wanted to increase my strength. And there were women in my dojo who started around the same time who were much younger than me, and they were advancing more rapidly. And also a couple of them became very close to some of the senior students who were men in the dojo, so they got to work out with these senior students. Mm-hmm. And when I compared myself to them, I of course fell short. And then I realized, well, they're learning Aikido perhaps faster and could be of benefit. And I asked them to work out with me and to show me some of the things they were learning, which they were happy to do. And so it was, a mutual benefit. They got to teach a little bit. I got to learn a lot. And that feeling of being in competition with them just dissolved. So I think that's one precept that can help. And the way I talked about Diane Rossetto, because she words this precept as meeting others on equal ground. And I think it's such a helpful concept. When we meet somebody new, can we meet that person with an open mind, meet them as a stranger, or even people that we know? Can we try to be open to one another in a way that can be of mutual benefit, and where we can, even if we notice that comparison, to just see it as the pattern of our mind. It's not necessarily the way things are. And I think, working with sympathetic joy is one thing that I think helps with comparing mind. And another practice that I learned is actually through accepting that I do things in a way that's unique to me, and I can't try to be like someone else. It doesn't work. And this came home to me one time in a ceremony at Tassajara when I was a student there. That periodically, in each practice period, we would have a shosan ceremony where everyone gets to ask the teacher what question. It's a little bit like the shuso ceremony, but it's the leader of the practice period, and you get to ask a question. And I had just recently been ordained, and I was really still feeling very awkward with my robes and all the fabric, and I was watching Linda Ruth, my teacher, during the practice period. So my question was, how can I learn to bow like you? Because I thought she was really graceful when she bowed. And she said, you can't bow like me, you have to bow like yourself, bow in your own way. And it carried over to many other things. It wasn't just I wanted to bow like her, I wanted to be like her. And there's no way I could be like her. Each of us grew up in a very different family and had very different life experiences. And so could I learn to just appreciate my own situation, my own strengths, and not want to be like someone else? I mean, in a way, if there are qualities in another person that we admire, it can help us to actually develop those qualities in ourselves. But if it's possible to do that without feeling that we're lacking, we're not as good as that other person. And this comes up frequently, so The other day I was in the sewing room. I've seen some of you in the sewing room at City Center. It's a wonderful place to be. And I've been sewing quite a while because I sewed my first rakusu. I was lay ordained in 1998. And I love sewing, so I often look for sewing projects for other people, even if I'm not sewing something for myself. But I was sewing on an okesa, and someone it was her second time at sewing class, and she was trying to get her namukie butsu stitch to look even. And she asked if she could look at my stitches close up, and she said, "Oh, I want to do stitches like you." And I said, "Well, it's really not helpful to compare your stitches to my stitches. You know, your stitches are your own stitches, and with practice, you'll find your own stitch. It'll be your stitch, won't be my stitch." And I hope that was helpful to her. I don't know if she said at the end that it was encouraging to see my stitches, but I hope it can be discouraging if you think that you can, that when you start out doing something, it's going to look a certain way or sound. You know, you start out learning the bells as Dohan, it takes a while to get to know the bell and to be able to find a sound that is pleasing to the ear and not harsh. So, you know, just acknowledging sometimes we're beginners at things, and it's fine to be starting out and finding our own way. I wanted to share something Reb Anderson says. He also writes about the precepts in his book, Being Upright. "One of the ways that we express our attachment to self is our constant effort to present ourselves in a favorable light." So this is part of working with meeting others on equal ground. "We exaggerate our merits or lie outright in order to convince ourselves or others that we are praiseworthy. We often express self-praise by comparing ourselves favorably with others, thus either intentionally or unintentionally disparaging others. And we're always monitoring and judging our conduct to determine if it's worthy of praise or blame." And if you can resonate with that, it's really a source of pain. When we praise ourselves and put others down, or the opposite. So how does this precept relate to the teachings of Vimalakirti? I think it's because meeting ourselves and others on equal ground is an expression of non-duality. It's an expression of connection and of appreciation for what everybody has to teach us through their actions, through how they are. And if we can approach people in that way, we can have meetings that involve learning. You know, it's like having a conversation where even if you have an opinion about something, you're interested in what the other person's point of view is. So you can have a learning conversation, and one that will help you connect rather than start arguing if you have different points of view. So I think bringing curiosity to our conversations, to our meetings with people, is an expression of non-duality, which Vimalakirti taught about. So we all want to open, this is a quote from Reb, "We all want to open our eyes and hearts with someone and finally see the truth." And when in Reb's talking about this precept, he says, "I would like to issue a fierce invitation to everyone to come and meet one another face to face in the spirit of devotion to the welfare of others." Meet everyone face to face in the spirit of devotion to the welfare of others. And I think that embodies Vimalakirti's spirit. I'm really realizing that I don't have too much time left, and I wanted to share a contemporary exemplar. Tagan Layton, when he talks about each of the bodhisattvas, finds contemporary exemplars who embody like the compassion of Avalokiteshvara, for example, or the energy of Samantabhadra. And when I thought about Vimalakirti, I thought about a Palestinian poet called Taha Muhammad Ali, who had an experience when he was, I think it was only eight, in 1948, when the Israeli army destroyed the town that he grew up in, and his family moved to Lebanon. They were shelling the town, so his family escaped to Lebanon, and they came back a year later and found the whole town was demolished. And he didn't have a formal education, but he was an avid reader, and he read poets from many different traditions. And later in life, he was a storekeeper in Nazareth. He had a souvenir store, and he would meet people, and sometimes he would exchange poetry with people, and later became very well known. And he wrote a poem called Revenge, which I'd like to share with you. At times, I wish I could meet in a duel the man who killed my father and raised our home, expelling me into a narrow country. And if he killed me, I'd rest at last. And if I were ready, I would take my revenge. But if it came to light when my rival appeared that he had a mother waiting for him, or a father who'd put his right hand over the heart's place in his chest whenever his son was late, even by just a quarter hour, for a meeting they'd set, then I would not kill him, even if I could. Likewise, I would not murder him if it were soon made clear that he had a brother or sisters who loved him and constantly longed to see him, or if he had a wife to greet him and children who couldn't bear his absence and whom his gifts would thrill, or if he had friends or companions, neighbors he knew, or allies from prison or a hospital room, or classmates from his school asking about him and sending him regards. But if he turned out to be on his own, cut off like a branch from a tree, without a mother or father, with neither a brother nor sister, wifeless, without a child, and without kin or neighbors or friends, colleagues or companions, then I'd add not a thing to his pain within that aloneness, not the torment of death, and not the sorrow of passing away. Instead, I'd be content to ignore him when I passed him by on the street, as I convinced myself that paying him no attention in itself was a kind of revenge. So I think what this poem says to me is that the worst possible situation is to not have anyone in your life, to be isolated, and that Taha, the poet, would not be able to kill someone, even someone who had killed his father, if that person would be sorely missed by his loved ones. So in a way, he's able to extend himself to the killer of his father through his imagination, and realize that he would not be able to commit an act of revenge because this person was loved by others and would be missed, just as his own father had been missed. So that quality of meeting others on equal ground, I think resonates through Taha Muhammad Ali's and through his life. Even if he was imprisoned and he had a very difficult life, but he was known to be friendly, to be humble, to reach out to people through his souvenir store, just being in the community, a member of the community. So I think I just want to end with a couple of thoughts about all of us as bodhisattvas, that bodhisattvas are not merely archetypes, Tigan Layton says. Bodhisattvas are great cosmic beings helping us all to become bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are simply ordinary beings making their way back to Buddha. Bodhisattvas appear in the nooks and crannies of your life. Soon you may start seeing them more clearly. They're just around the corner. Bodhisattvas are not limited by what we say they are or are not. We are all bodhisattvas. So, thank you very much for your attention. And I think we have about 7 minutes for questions and comments.
We have more than that.
We have more than that?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Okay. Does anyone have any thoughts? Or yes, I don't know your name.
So, praising yourself at the expense of others, but the opposite of that is the idea if you praise others, is that you're trying to make yourself more important because you're trying to seem altruistic. Is that the idea?
No, I think if you praise others at the expense of yourself, it's because you put yourself down.
Oh, okay.
So you might not feel worthy. You're not as good as someone else, or you're not as smart as someone else.
Okay.
So it's that kind of, it's the reverse of praising others. But often we tend to put ourselves down rather than to think we're better than. And either way, whichever way we're focusing, we're not meeting others on equal ground. Does that make sense? Yeah, Terry.
Well, Tove, as you know, as my teacher, that this is the precept I have engaged in, you know, the most deeply. And it was great to be reminded I had read Diane Rossetto's book, but I'd forgotten about her formulation of it. And it was really great to be reminded of it. But I find this compulsion so powerful in me. Sometimes I wonder if it's sort of biologically based, in other words, that status, people with higher status were, is an evolutionary, a product of evolution, but that your status in the group determined your, you know, chances of survival, and therefore those who, you know, sought high status were more likely to survive, and therefore it's so strong in us. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but it's just so strong, even though I see it, to let go of it, it's kind of shocking. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, it is very strong, and it's very, sometimes very hard to recognize. I think it has to do with our, how hard it is to be aware of our power and privilege. And I don't know if it's biological, but it's certainly, how do you say, psychological, sociological, you know, we're born into a family with wherever that family is in terms of class and race, that becomes part of what we have to work with, you know, and it's hard to see privilege when we have it, and also when we don't have it, to not harbor resentment sometimes towards people who do have it, but you know, I think we always have the potential of recognizing our conditioning and being able to work with it in a way that doesn't separate us from others. It does take work because it's often just the air we breathe. I mean, it's like that for me about being white. I do things, I think things that I feel are part of my conditioning as a white person. I just don't recognize sometimes. Often, the more I'm studying white privilege, the more I realize that I take so much for granted that has to do with my being white and gives me more privilege, and that can cause pain to someone else without my intending it at all. So it takes, I think, a lot of effort if you have privilege in any area of your life to work with that and not not use it in an unconscious way. So that's what I would say. I don't know about the biological part. Yes.
So you think it's more of a learned behavior, a social conditioning too?
I do.
That comparison. What are we to take away from teachers who, for instance, teaching sewing, if, for example, if we're to find our own stitch, what do we take away from people who we consciously choose to be teachers for us?
I think they can encourage us to be true to ourselves, to find out what our own expression is, for example, our own expression of the Dharma. Through your actions, through your words. I mean, if you choose a teacher, that teacher will inspire you to bring out the best in you, not to be like them, I think, you know. And I think we choose teachers because of some sense of affinity, and there is something in the teacher's way that speaks to us and can encourage us. But it's really helping us develop ourselves as fully as possible, you know, be our own true selves. And I'm thinking with the sewing too. So, you know, one reason why I think it's helpful to have a sewing teacher is that at least the sewing teachers that I've worked with, they can be so helpful when you're making mistakes, when you're learning a stitch, when you're you don't know how to pin things. Just by being patient and encouraging. And I've been in the sewing room with people who've never sewn before, and people with disabilities who learn how to sew their rakusus, and their rakusus will be an expression of their ability and their practice. You know, it's no two rakusus look alike.
So. And if a teacher disappoints us, how might one process that?
That's painful. But we have to look at also what are we bringing to the situation. It's usually, you know, whenever we're disappointed with someone or may have to do with as much with our expectations or perhaps expecting a teacher to be a certain way that they're not, or not being able to accept that even a beloved teacher can make mistakes or might do things differently from the way we would do them. I think to have some compassion for the teacher and for ourselves. But that can be very painful.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anyone else? Okay, thank you so much for your attention and I hope that you will find a way to cherish yourselves and your practice, and to enjoy the rest of the practice period, and particularly just this coming ceremony. This Shuso entering ceremony, I think, is just a real gift to the whole Sangha. So hope you have a very good day.
May our attention equally extend to every